This is Audible.
McGraw-Hill Professional presents Mind Gym, an athlete's guide to inner excellence. Written by Gary Mack with David Cass Stevens. Foreword by Alex Rodriguez. Narrated by Kevin Young. Foreword. When I was 9 years old, growing up in Miami, I dreamed of being a Major League Baseball player someday. The dream was a little blurry back then, and it disappeared when I quit baseball and took up basketball. I wanted to become the next Magic Johnson or the next Larry Bird. Then one day I was talking with my mother and my older brother, and I realized that there aren't too many Dominicans playing in the NBA. So after a 2-year layoff, I started playing baseball again, and that picture in my head, that dream, came back to me. That blurry image started taking focus. I can tell you I wouldn't be where I am now if I hadn't seen myself wearing a big league uniform long before it happened. I believe in the power of dreams. I also believe mental preparation goes hand in hand with setting goals and hard work. The way I use my mind is the biggest reason I've been able to enjoy success and play at a high level in a game where you have to prove yourself every day. In sports, as in life, talent will take you just so far. I try to attain goals mentally first. Let me give you an example. I don't want to sound cocky, but early in the 1996 season, I visualized winning the American League Most Valuable Player Award and holding it above my head. I visioned winning the batting title and holding up that trophy, too. I visioned a .380 batting average. In my mind, I could see the number flashing and blinking on exit signs. 380, 380, 380. That year, I missed winning the MVP by 3 votes and won the batting title. Playing the game was the easy part. The real work was in the preparation. What I did in May paid off with rewards in November. Just as I believe in dreams, I believe in the power of positive reinforcement and visualization. Some nights, when I go to bed, I will tell myself maybe 150 times, I hit the ball solid. I hit the ball solid. What do I do for a living? I hit the ball solid. I see the results from my mind's eye, out. I see myself from the fan's perspective, from the manager's view in the dugout. I picture myself on the field from different angles. I believe a champion wins in his mind first, then he plays the game, not the other way around. It's powerful stuff. My season is long, extending from spring training through 162 games and the playoffs. Every athlete in every sport experiences peaks and valleys. During tough times, I don't worry. I don't judge my performance by results. Most important is my physical and mental preparation. The question I ask when I look in the mirror is, am I ready to play? If the answer is yes, I feel confident. Once the ball is thrown or it's hit, the outcome is out of your control. I have known Gary Mack as a team counselor and as a friend since 1993, when I became a professional baseball player. Mind Gym takes you into the hearts and minds of many of the world's greatest athletes and coaches and illustrates the importance of the inner game. The lessons and mental skills you will learn are the same ones I use on a daily basis, whether you're a big leaguer or a little leaguer, or in whatever game you play. Gary and this book can help take your game to the next level. Alex Rodriguez. Part 1. Welcome to the Inner Game. Yogi was right. 90% of the game is half mental. Yogi Berra. You have to train your mind like you train your body. Bruce Jenner. When Yogi Berra became manager of the Yankees, a reporter asked if he had enough experience to handle the job. "Sure," Berra said. "I've been playing 18 years, and you can observe a lot just by watching." Closing his notebook, the writer walked away wearing the same look of faint bewilderment that the waitress had after she asked Yogi if he wanted his pizza cut into 4 slices or 8. "Better make it 4, Yogi decided. "I don't know if I can eat 8. In working with elite athletes and professional sports teams, I often began my counseling sessions and presentations by quoting Yogi's wit and wisdom. A favorite line, one certain to get a laugh, is Yogi's mathematical observation that 90% of the game is half mental. But let me ask a question. Have you ever thought seriously about that famous Yogiism? How much of the game, your game, is mental? Maybe I can lead you to an answer. Let's begin with an exercise I introduced to an international group of sports psychologists, Olympic and professional athletes, coaches, musicians, dancers, astronauts, doctors, lawyers, and fire chiefs in Ottawa, Canada. After completing this exercise and answering the questions, I think you will discover what the world's greatest athletes and the most successful people in other walks of life know to be true, that once you reach a certain level of competency, the mental skills become as important to performance as the physical skills, if not more so. Now sit back, relax, begin to recall the sights and sounds and feelings of you performing at your very best. In your mind's eye, imagine your best day ever. Picture that time when you were at the top of your game, when every move and decision you made was the right one, when it seemed like every break went your way. Some athletes and performers describe their best day experience as playing in the zone. I call those sweet spots in time white moments, which we will explore later. Imagine you are watching your own highlights film. You feel no fear, no anxieties, and no self-doubts. Everything is flowing and going your way. Look around. Where are you? What time of day is it? What time of year? What are you wearing? Who is with you? Who is watching? What do you hear? Breathe in the air. If you were on a playing field or a golf course, can you smell the grass? Visualize that pleasurable experience. Now, let that image slowly fade, and in its place, recall your worst performance. Think of the game, event, or experience when you felt weak and ineffective, when nothing went your way no matter how hard you tried. Now leave that memory behind. Fast forward to the present. With Yogi's quote in mind, compare yourself competing at your best and at your worst. Then, honestly answer these questions. What percentage of the difference in those performances had to do with your physical skills? What percentage was mental? When working with a team of professional athletes, I have everyone in the clubhouse stand. I ask if the mental part of their performance was less than 10%. If so, I tell them to sit down. Those who think it was less than 20% are asked to take a seat. How about those of you, I ask, who think the mental game was less than 30%? Sit down. How about less than 40%? At 50%, at least half the room is still standing. Would you be standing too? If the answer is yes, this is my next question. If you believe the difference between your best and worst performance was, as Yogi said, at least 50% mental, then how much time do you spend on the mental game? How many books about sports psychology have you read? How many lessons have you taken from a head coach? As you demonstrated in the exercise, the mind is like a VCR. It records sights and sounds, and the tape plays continuously. The human body treats every vivid thought and image as if it is real and happening now. Everyone who has awakened from a nightmare knows this to be true. Studies have proven that mental training will not only enhance performance and improve productivity, but also add to your enjoyment. Whatever your age, whatever your game, you can learn how to use your mind more constructively. You can learn how to stay focused. You can learn to deal with adversity. Stay motivated during difficult times. Avoid fatal distractions. You can learn how to follow your dreams and live your life on purpose. Achieving inner excellence is a process. Building mental muscle, like building physical muscle, requires time and effort. The more you work on the inside, the more it will show on the outside. First, you must make a commitment. As Yogi supposedly said, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. By listening to the first section, you are taking the first step. Think of the audiobook you're listening to as your mind gym. Listen to the lessons, do the exercises, and answer the questions. If you do, you will acquire the skills needed to create the ideal mental state that will allow you to rise to the next level and perform at your best by choice rather than chance. What you think affects how you feel and perform. Training your brain is as important as training your body. Mind games. The mind messes up more shots than the body. Tommy Bolt. The mind is a powerful thing, and most people don't use it properly. Mark McGuire. Gene Stallings stood on the practice field, arms folded across his chest. The Arizona Cardinals were at summer training camp in Flagstaff, and every player could feel the stoic presence of the team's tall, tough-minded head coach. Stallings is a protege of the late Paul Bear Bryant. He played for Bryant at Texas A&M and served 7 seasons as an assistant to the coaching legend at Alabama. Like Bryant, Stallings valued practice time. He placed a premium on mental toughness and the work habits of his players. Now here he stood, casting a long shadow, his steely gaze fixed on a place kicker as he swung his right foot, soccer style, into and through the ball. When the field goal attempt sailed wildly wide of the mark, the kicker shanked the ball. Stallings' face hardened like ready-mixed cement. In disgust, he turned his back and walked away, muttering under his breath. Once Gene was out of earshot, I drew the kicker aside. "What happened?" I asked. This was my first season as team counselor for the NFL club. "Mac, I'm a great field goal kicker," the player said with conviction. Then he thought of his coach and his glacial stare. He shook his head. "But I just can't kick when Gene's watching me." "Well, you know," I said gently, unable to suppress a smile, "I think he's going to be at all the games." The kicker had plenty of leg, and distance was no problem. But he had allowed himself to become self-conscious and coach-conscious rather than task-conscious. His mind was on his boss. If the player expected better results, he had to change his thought patterns. He needed to work on the mental part of his game. One key to achieving success in sports is learning how to focus on the task and not let negative thoughts intrude. The mind can concentrate on only one thing at a time. So rather than suppress what you don't want to happen, you must focus on what you do want to happen, or on some neutral thought. In working with place kickers, I use a distraction technique. I ask them to create a word that, when said to themselves, will block out all negative thought and help relieve tension. Al Del Greco, a veteran kicker for the Tennessee Titans, who played in Super Bowl 34, had his own word, birdie. Al is a scratch golfer, perhaps the best golfer in the National Football League. For him, birdie creates the feeling of success and reminds him of the fun he has on the golf course. The brain is like a mega computer that controls the body. Herbert Benson, a Harvard cardiologist, found that having patients focus on their breathing and repeating the word one lowered their blood pressure and heart rate. Try it yourself. The brain can do remarkable things, but unlike a computer, it doesn't come with an instruction manual. Unfortunately, too often we pull up the wrong programs at the wrong times. This section begins with a profound quote from Tommy Bolt, the former professional golfer. Terrible Tommy, he was called. Thunderbolt. The joke was that Bolt was bilingual, fluent in English and profanity. His temper and club-throwing tantrums are part of golf's rich lore. According to legend, after lipping out 6 putts in a row during one tournament round, Bolt shook his fist at the heavens and shouted, "Why don't you come down and fight like a man?" But Bolt understood the power of the mind and how the brain can sabotage performance. When a weekend golfer arrives at a water hole, what is the second thing he does after fishing an old ball, a water ball, out of his bag? Stepping to the tee, he tells himself, "Don't hit it in the water." What we've learned in psychology is that actions follow our thoughts and images. If you say, "Don't hit it in the water," and you're looking at the water, you have just programmed your mind to send the ball to a watery grave. The law of dominant thought says your mind is going to remember the most dominant thought. Think water, remember water, and water is likely what you will get. Rather than say, "Don't hit it in the water," try another instruction like, "Land the ball 10 yards to the right of the pin." You get what your mind sets. The mind works most effectively when you're telling it what to do rather than what not to do. When I was with the Chicago Cubs, a starting pitcher telephoned me from Montreal. He had been rocked in his last outing. In an almost pleading voice, he said he needed help. When I asked him to relate the conversation he had with himself when he was alone on the mound, struggling to find the plate, he ticked off a laundry list of negative thoughts. "Don't hang your curve. Don't walk this guy. The ump won't give me a call. If I don't get through the fifth inning, I'm going to lose my spot in the rotation." I give athletes I work with a 3x5 card. On one side, I have them list their personal keys to success. On the other, their performance keys to success. I asked the Cubs pitcher to tell me his performance keys to success. "What are you doing when you're really on your game?" "I'm locating my fastball," he replied. "I'm throwing first pitch strikes. I'm changing speed." "How do you do those things?" I asked. "Good balance," he said. "Shoulder back, drive through." "Good," I told him. "In 5 days, you start against the Mets in New York. All I want you to do before the game is to focus on those 3 things. In his next appearance, the pitcher threw a complete game shutout. In less than a week, he couldn't have changed that much physically. His turnaround is proof that by changing your thinking, and you can choose how you think, you can change your performance. Put another way, if you don't like the program you are watching, switch the channel. Learn to use your mind, or your mind will use you. Actions follow our thoughts and images. Don't look where you don't want to go. The head edge. The whole idea is to get an edge. Sometimes it takes just a little extra something to get that edge, but you have to have it. Don Shula. The most important part of a player's body is above his shoulders. Ty Cobb. Moments before his last at-bat of the 1998 season, baseball's new man of steel sat in the shadows of the St. Louis dugout with his eyes closed. Mark McGwire wasn't napping. The man with the broad shoulders and Popeye forearms, who had already hit one home run that late September afternoon, was deep in thought, mentally rehearsing. "It's hard work, mentally and physically," the Cardinals slugger once said of the art of hitting. Everybody looks at my body, but I use my mind more than my arms. By the time McGuire stepped into the batter's box, he was focused, relaxed, and ready. When Montreal relief pitcher Carl Pavano turned loose a 95-mile-per-hour fastball, Big Mac's mind and body worked as one. A ripping swing, a cork-popping sound, away it went, a streaking line drive. The ball landed in the left field stands for home run number 70, proving to the last skeptic that Big Mac's 69 others that season weren't flukes. McGuire hit 5 home runs in the last 44 hours of the season and waved goodbye to Sammy Sosa, with whom he had formed a mutual admiration club and competed in a dinger derby unlike anything baseball had ever seen. Sports psychology has been called the science of success because it studies what successful people do. What we have found, and what McGuire and other great athletes validate, is the value of mental rehearsal and imagery. Here is how Carl Yastrzemski described his use of imagery. "The night before a game, I visualize the pitcher and the pitches I'm going to see the next day. I hit the ball right on the button. I know what it's going to feel like. I hit the pitches where I want to." The power of visualization and mental rehearsal has been demonstrated in dozens of research studies. If you take 20 athletes of equal ability and give 10 mental training, they will outperform the 10 who received no mental training every time. This is what we call the head edge. One interesting study involved college basketball players. For 3 months, one group shot free throws for 1 hour each day. Another group spent an hour each day thinking about shooting free throws. The third group shot baskets 30 minutes a day and spent 30 minutes visualizing the ball going through the hoop from the foul line. Which group at the end of the study do you think improved its free throw shooting the most? The third group did. The imagery had as much impact on accuracy as shooting baskets. In another case study, cited in Foundations of Sport and Exercise Psychology, a sports psychologist worked with the United States Olympic ski team. He divided the team into two groups equally matched for ski racing ability. One group received imagery training. The other served as a control group. The coach quickly realized that the skiers practicing imagery were improving more rapidly than those in the control group. He called off the experiment and insisted that all his skiers be given the opportunity to train using imagery. As a kid growing up in an immigrant neighborhood in Queens, New York, I played on a soccer team in the Polish-American Youth League. One Saturday, we went to Randall's Island for a clinic. I sat in wonder in the presence of Pele, the greatest soccer player in the world. I still remember what he said. "Enthusiasm and the mental edge are the keys to winning." Pele described his routine, which was the same for every game he played. An hour before he stepped onto the field, Pele went into the locker room, picked up 2 towels, and retreated to a private corner. Stretching out, he placed 1 towel under the back of his head, like a pillow. He covered his eyes with the other. Then he began to roll his mental camera. In his mind's eye, he saw himself as a youngster playing soccer on the beaches of Brazil. He could feel the gentle breeze. He could smell the salt air. He remembered how much fun he had and how much he loved the game. Pele then hit the fast-forward button of his mental video. He began recalling his greatest moments in the World Cup and reliving that winning feeling. Then he let those images fade and began rehearsing for the upcoming game. He pictured his opponents. He saw himself dribbling through defenders, heading shots, and scoring goals. After a half hour in solitude, alone with his thoughts and the slideshow of positive images, Pele did his stretching exercises. When he trotted into the stadium, washed in cheers, he knew he was physically and mentally prepared. An exercise for this section is called the Mind Gym. When I was with the Cubs, the team acquired Bob Tewksbury from the Yankees. At the time, Bob wasn't a dominating big league pitcher. He didn't have a great fastball, relying instead on location and changes in speed. In working together, I asked Bob to create his own mind gym, an imaginary retreat where he could go before games to reflect and mentally prepare. His vivid imagination created an elaborate studio. Bob's mind gym featured a bubble-like structure, an energy machine with a ticker tape that flashed positive affirmations, and a state-of-the-art sound system. From his mind gym bed, Bob could stretch out and watch a highlights tape of himself on a big-screen TV mounted overhead. Tewksbury later bloomed into an all-star with the Cardinals. To get the head edge, try creating your own mind gym. You always can do mental practice, even when you are physically tired or injured. Make your images as vivid and as clear as you can. See yourself overcoming mistakes and imagine yourself doing things well. Remember, confidence comes from knowing you are mentally and physically prepared. Sports psychology is the science of success. Studies show that within a group of athletes of equal ability, those who receive mental training outperform those who don't almost every time. Mental skills, like physical skills, need constant practice. The pressure principle. Under pressure, you can perform 15% better or worse. Scott Hamilton. When you have fun, it changes all the pressure into pleasure. Ken Griffey Sr. and Ken Griffey Jr. He was a sickly child, his growth stunted by a rare digestive disease. Kids at school called him Peanut and other hurtful names. A figure skating judge said he was too small to succeed in international competition. But now here he was, on center stage, at 5'3", 115 pounds, the biggest attraction of the Winter Olympics. Figure skating is the main event of the Winter Games. It is rich theater, made for TV drama. The anticipation is delicious. For the performers, the pressure is palpable. One tiny mistake, one fraction of a point deducted by unforgiving judges, can mean the difference between triumph and tears. Scott Hamilton stood alone in the spotlight. In 1980, the American skater had finished fifth at the Games in Lake Placid. Now, after 4 years of working on eliminating his weaknesses in training, after 4 years of waiting and dreaming, this was his chance, perhaps his last chance, to win an Olympic gold medal. Hamilton took a deep breath and launched body and soul into his routine. He glided, jumped, and spun. Arms outstretched, he became one with the music, his flashing skate blades cutting stencils in the ice. 4 minutes later, it was over. Bravos filled the arena, and bouquets tossed from the stands littered the ice. The applause sounded like hard rain. Hamilton reminded us that winners come in all sizes. Wearing a shiny gold medal that hung almost to his waist, the American Olympic champion lived his dream. That night in Sarajevo, he credited his success to his mental preparedness. Under pressure, Hamilton said, people can perform 15% better or 15% worse. I was among the millions of TV viewers who witnessed Hamilton's performance that night. The skater's comment intrigued me. All of us are performers in the game of life. We face pressure and competition every day, at work, in the boardroom, in the classroom, on the golf course, on the tennis court, the basketball court, and at play. With Hamilton's quote in mind, I began a new career studying the psychology of stress and the psychology of success. My mission was to learn all I could about playing under pressure. I wanted to find out why, under pressure, some athletes break through, as Hamilton did, while others break down. In what ways and to what extent does the mind influence how we perform? What is pressure? Golfer Lee Trevino said, "Pressure is when you've got $35 riding on a 4-foot putt and you've only got $5 in your pocket." Former Pittsburgh Steelers coach Chuck Knoll defined pressure as something you feel only when you don't know what you're doing. During the late stages of a pennant race, former Montreal pitcher Bill Lee was asked how much pressure he was feeling. Never one to duck a question, baseball's space cadet thought a moment, then announced, 32 pounds per square inch at sea level. Charles Barkley, the former NBA star, glibly dismisses the subject, saying, pressure is what you put in tires. But pressure is real. Pressure exists. Every athlete, whether he or she admits it, feels pressure in competition. So where does pressure come from? Former Denver Broncos quarterback John Elway, a future NFL Hall of Famer, said he always felt the pressure to win, but most of that pressure came from within. Hockey great Marc Messier agrees. The only pressure I'm under is the pressure I put on myself. The human body reacts to pressure and stress. The heart beats faster, and breathing quickens. No one is immune. Jack Nicklaus, who has won more major championships than any golfer in history, says, pressure creates tension, and when you're tense, you want to get your task over and done with as fast as possible. The more you hurry in golf, the worse you probably will play, which leads to an even heavier pressure and greater tension. Listen to tennis star Arthur Ashe. We have a natural tendency to invest more energy when we are under pressure. But when tension rises, two things happen. The feet can't move, and the diaphragm collapses. It's automatic. It's in the genetic code. Pressure gets a bad name, but it can bring out the best in you. In fact, if you don't feel any pressure, you're probably not going to do your best. Former big league pitcher Goose Gossage thrived on pressure. I'm not at my best, Gossage once said, until the situation is at its worst. I got to know Gossage when I worked with the Cubs and later the Seattle Mariners. Goose was a master at keeping his job in perspective. I remember asking him how he handled the pressure of being a closer. Gossage said, "Every time I come into a game, I think of my home and the Rockies, and that relaxes me. And I tell myself the worst thing that could happen is that I'd be home fishing there tomorrow." Hamilton dealt with pressure in another way. 16 years after watching him win the gold medal, I spoke with Scott when he was in Phoenix with the Stars on Ice tour. When I told him that his 15% quote about pressure became my inspiration for writing this book, the skater smiled. Hamilton said he approached his gold medal performance in Sarajevo with a refined indifference. He had trained for years to prepare for that moment. When the spotlight came on and the music began, he let fate carry him through. The hard work was over. Now, he told himself, go out and enjoy. Sarah Hughes chose the same approach at the 2002 Winter Games in Salt Lake City. In fourth place, after the short program and feeling she had nothing to lose, the 16-year-old took a leap of faith and skated with abandon. Sports Illustrated described her performance as uninhibited joy. While older, more experienced Olympians faltered under pressure, Sarah made history by landing 2 triple-triple combinations and won the gold. "I didn't hold back," Hughes said, beaming. "It was my greatest skate ever." Pressure can be a positive force or a negative one. A close friend, Ken Revisa, is one of the first sports psychologists to publish a study on the experiences of athletes during their greatest moment in sports. He found that more than 80% of the athletes said they felt no fear of failure. They weren't thinking about their performance. They were immersed in the activity. They were in the zone. The probability of achieving the outcome you want increases when you let go of the need to have it. Go into your mental studio, which we discussed in the last section. Recall a time when you broke through, when the pressure worked for you. Notice what you were doing, feeling, and saying to yourself. Were you relaxed or tense? Excited or anxious? Did you fear failure or feel a desire to win? Were you focused on the outcome or absorbed in the process? Everything gets interpreted. Pressure is in the brain of the beholder. Learn to view pressure as a challenge to meet rather than a threat of defeat. Mental toughness. The most important attribute a player must have is mental toughness. Mia Hamm. Competitive toughness is an acquired skill and not an inherited gift. Chris Evert. When Joe Bugel coached the Arizona Cardinals, the highest praise he could bestow upon a player was to call him an LTG, short for legitimate tough guy. An LTG is a fierce competitor, a battler, an athlete who looks at pressure as a challenge, who refuses to lose, and never ever quits. An example of an LTG in another sport is the soccer player who once had the ball stolen during a scrimmage. As the defender turned upfield, the player who lost the ball began yanking on the thief's jersey and didn't let go until he fell to the ground, his shirt half off. He lay there grinning in disbelief and admiration at the girl who had fouled him and then walked away without a glance back. Her name is Mariel Margaret Hamm, the highest scoring woman in the history of international soccer, is the definition of mental toughness. Shy by nature and labeled a reluctant star, Mia told her teammates, "Nothing stands between us and success but our will to win." It was Mia who said, "Our warrior mentality means that once we step on the field, we are coming after you with a take-no-prisoners attitude." The U.S. women's soccer team was the sports story of the year in 1999. The Americans won the World Cup, outlasting China in a final game that featured two exhausting overtimes and a dramatic shootout. If Mia Hamm wasn't the heart of her team, then she was the left ventricle. In this section, we will define the seven characteristics of mental toughness. They are a set of behaviors and beliefs about yourself, your work, your sport, and how you interact. A person who is mentally tough looks at competition as a challenge to rise up to rather than a threat to back down from. Like physical skills, mental toughness can be learned through quality instruction and practice. Competitive. Professional golfer Nancy Lopez clearly defines a competitor. "A competitor will find a way to win," she said. "Competitors take bad breaks and use them to drive themselves just that much harder. Quitters take bad breaks and use them as reasons to give up." Michael Jordan's flirtation with a Major League Baseball career is testimony to his competitive fire. Why would the greatest basketball player in history attempt to play another sport? Because he couldn't accept not trying. Late in life, Joe DiMaggio said he would give away all his trophies and records to be 25 years old and able to compete again. "The one thing I both loved and now miss the most," DiMaggio said, "was the competition." Confident. Tiger Woods said, "Every time I play, in my own mind, I'm the favorite." Confident athletes have a can-do attitude, a belief they can handle whatever comes their way. They almost never fall victim to self-defeating thoughts. Jordan said he went into every game believing he was the best player on the court until someone proved otherwise. Very few did. Control. Successful athletes are able to control their emotions and behavior. They focus on what they can control and don't allow things that are out of their control to affect them. The hallmark of mentally tough athletes is the ability to maintain poise, concentration, and emotional control under the greatest pressure and the most challenging situations. Committed. Mentally tough athletes focus their time and energy on their goals and dreams. They are self-directed and highly motivated. Listen to John McEnroe. There are scores of players who can hit every shot in the book who never make it into a Grand Slam event. Those who make it are there because they are mentally tougher. They wanted it more. After his free fall from the top of the tennis rankings, Andre Agassi rededicated himself to the game. He worked hard to get back into shape. The results speak for themselves. Composure. Mentally tough athletes know how to stay focused and deal with adversity. In working with hockey teams, I'll sometimes approach a player in the locker room and give him a shove when he isn't looking. I want to see his reaction. Oftentimes, the player will instinctively make a fist and draw back his arm, ready to throw a punch. In hockey and basketball, the athlete who retaliates is usually the one who gets penalized. I tell tennis players they can expect 2 or 3 bad calls in every match, sometimes more. How they manage their emotions can determine whether they win or lose. A mentally tough player will say to himself, "Okay, if I've got to beat the other guy and the referee, then fine, I'll do that." The motto I give to firefighters in the Phoenix Fire Department also applies to you. Keep your cool when the heat is on. Courage. A mentally tough athlete must be willing to take a risk. That's what peak performers do. In the book Adversity Quotient, author Paul Stoltz compares success with a mountain. Only climbers get to the top. The campers, those who get part of the way up and decide to stay where they are, will never feel as alive or as proud as the climbers. As the philosopher said, it takes courage to grow up and to achieve your full potential. Consistency. Mentally tough athletes possess an inner strength. They often play their best when they're feeling their worst. They don't make excuses. Competition is won or lost on the 6-inch playing field between the ears. Practice the 7 C's of mental toughness. Learn to love the competition. Know your numbers. In a close game, I check my pulse. I know if it gets over 100. It's going to affect my thinking. Phil Jackson. Mentally, I try to stay at a medium level, not too high or too low. Todd Zeal. In graduate school, the most important psychological concept I learned is something called the performance curve. Draw an upside-down U. To the left, draw a vertical line and connect it to a horizontal line drawn beneath the inverted U. Number both lines incrementally from 0 to 10. The horizontal line represents stress and arousal. The vertical line represents performance and productivity. As athletes become stimulated, their numbers on both lines increase. When they achieve peak efficiency, when they are performing at their best, physically and mentally, they are at the top of the human function curve, at the apex of the inverted U. Everyone has an optimal number that corresponds with peak performance. I tell all athletes I work with that they need to know their numbers. They also need to recognize their early warning signs. Imagine you were a car. How many RPMs should you be producing so your motor is running smoothly and efficiently, not chugging along too slowly, but also not going over the red line? An athlete's ideal numbers, the optimal level of performance, depend upon 1, his or her temperament, 2, the time or length of the event, and 3, the nature of the task. A sprinter wouldn't have the same number as a marathon runner because the time of the event is different. A basketball center, whose job is muscling opponents under the basket, would have a different number than, say, a three-point shooter. This is also true of starting pitchers and relievers. The nature of their task is different. Athletes have different emotional makeups. Some are more high-strung than others. To use the car analogy, one athlete might be a Porsche, another a pickup truck. Just as it's important to know what to do when your vehicle's oil or brake light comes on, it's important to recognize your own early warning signs. When I was with the Cubs, I taught a class on the mental aspects of performing along with former Major League pitcher Jim Colburn. To illustrate what I meant by early warning signs, I would look around the room in the church basement where we met and select one of the pitchers to come to the front of the class and read a chapter of the manual aloud. With some, all you had to do was look at them. Hoping they wouldn't be summoned, they shrank before my eyes. One of the greatest fears many people have is the fear of public speaking. Under stress, some people are cardiac responders. Their heart rate goes up. Some are skin responders. They begin to perspire. Others begin to breathe rapidly, feel their stomachs churn, or feel their neck and back muscles tensing. These are all physical early warning signs. Mentally, our minds start racing. A little voice begins whispering negative thoughts. Not long ago, I received a phone call from an executive of a National Hockey League team. He told me about one of the club's top prospects, a promising high-round draft choice who had struggled during his rookie year. "This guy should be making millions," the executive said, "and he's only making thousands." By that, he meant the player, for whatever reason, was underperforming. He had not begun to tap his potential. I agreed to meet with the rookie before the club sent him down to the minor leagues. In our first session, the player confessed he felt a lot of pressure being a high-round draft pick. Whenever the game started, he became overly excited. During his first shift on the ice, he overskated the puck. His passes were too long. He lost his composure around the net. After we talked about the performance curve, I asked him, "What number are you?" "I'm a 9 or a 10," he said. "Sometimes I feel like I'm an 11. "What's your number when you're playing at your best?" I asked. "I'm a 6 or a 7. When the puck dropped, the young player's tachometer was already hitting the red line. Unhappy with the rookie's performance, the coach benched him. Later, when the rookie returned to the game, after sitting out several shifts, he said he felt a half-step slow. His legs were heavy. He missed passes. It was as if he couldn't get up to speed. "What's your number then?" I asked. 3 or 4, he replied. "Maybe 5. To help him calm down before games, we changed his routine. In the locker room, the young player began listening to slower music. During games, I instructed him to pretend he was going in with each shift change. By mentally skating every shift, he was better able to focus on the action and the opponent. Once he returned to the ice, he performed at 6 or 7, his peak performance number. I told him that performance is like the guitar he plays for relaxation. If the strings are too loose, the music is flat. If they're too tight, they could snap. Just as the instrument's strings need to be at the right tension, an athlete must have his body tuned for the right performance. Whenever I think of over-revving, I am reminded of Dexter Manley. In 1991, after his drug suspension, the former All-Pro with the Washington Redskins joined the Arizona Cardinals. On the day of the Cowboys game in Irving, Texas, a team doctor came to me. "Mac, you've got to go in there." I could hear the concern in his voice. He motioned anxiously toward the training room. "It's Dexter." Although we had known each other only a few weeks, Dexter and I enjoyed a good relationship. I liked him and believed he trusted me. When I entered the inner sanctum of the training room, Manly was the picture of pent-up emotion, as high-strung as a thoroughbred lathering in the paddock before the start of a race. His vacant eyes said he wasn't at home. Dexter was in another world. "Dexter? Dexter!" Slowly I got his attention. As Manly began to settle down, I looked him in the eye and asked what was going on. What was he thinking about? As kickoff neared, Manly said he pictured himself back in the Third Ward in Houston, the poor neighborhood where he grew up. "Mac, I don't ever want to be there again." In an attempt to psych himself up for the game, Manly had become over-aroused, which can be counterproductive in an athlete. Even though Dexter was a great pass rusher, the Cardinals didn't want to put him into the game on a third down in short yardage situations for fear he would jump offside and give the other team a free first down. The two cases illustrate the importance of the performance curve and knowing your numbers. A quote to remember came from former big league pitcher Carl Hubble, who invented the screwball. Hubble said, "I had no chance of controlling a ball game until I first controlled myself." You can't control your performance until you are in control of yourself. What you're thinking, how you're feeling, most importantly, your physiology. Know your numbers and your early warning signs. Responsibility psychology. What has benefited me the most is learning I can't control what happens outside of my pitching. Greg Maddux. My message is simple. Take control of your life. Charles Barkley. In 1989, Greg Maddux was struggling. The young Cubs pitcher who had attended some of my classes during the Fall Instructional League lost 5 of 6 decisions. His earned run average soared. After watching Maddux get roughed up, I made a promise to myself. If Greg didn't show improvement in his first outing after the All-Star break, I was going to call him, which I did. The transformation that followed the break was astounding. Beginning on July 23rd, Maddux won 5 in a row. On August 7th, his complete game victory over Montreal lifted the Cubs into first place in the division, where they stayed the remainder of the regular season. A lot of people asked me, "What did you tell him?" Nothing. When I called, Greg wasn't home. Sports psychology doesn't create talent. It can only help release it. Sharing the story is my way of being responsible, our topic in this section. In sports, as in life, your future and success depend upon many things, but mostly they depend upon you. You have the responsibility to shape your life. You are the person who pushes yourself forward or holds yourself back. The power to succeed or fail is yours alone. I like what Don Sutton, the Hall of Fame pitcher, said. "I think the reason for my success is that I was raised as a member of a sharecropping family in the South, and I had to take responsibility early in life." One of the great powers we have is the power to choose. How you choose to look at an event is going to affect how you feel and how you perform. I see a tendency in young pitchers to get upset with umpires or teammates who make infield mistakes. Too often, people play the blame game. Successful people take responsibility for themselves and their game. They understand that it's not the event, but how they respond to it that's most important. You have the choice how you will respond to any situation. People with inner excellence, like Greg Maddux, focus on what they can control. Maddux doesn't have a Hall of Fame build. "I don't look like a baseball player. I mean, look at me," the bespectacled Atlanta right-hander says. But Maddux, the most dominant pitcher of his generation, has a Hall of Fame brain. Maddux knows the only things he can control during a game are himself and his pitches. Tim Salmon, a former American League Rookie of the Year, said, "I can't control the pitcher, the ball,